in cash right now. Call 877-854-WINS. That's 877-854-9467. The 25th nationwide caller wins $1,000 on 580 KIDO. Fighting for America.
The 12-member jury decided not to press charges against Officer Darren Wilson.
Stop assassinating black people!
Town hall smashed up. Police cars on fire.
You need to stop throwing objects at the police.
One of the tear gas canisters on the street dispersing right now.
Fighting for Idaho.
This is 5 million people being given amnesty that Congress rejected, that the American people have rejected.
Fighting for you.
It's just such a great time of year to really be grateful for what we have and to celebrate what we've accomplished over the year and also to do things for others.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the Morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580 KIDO. Joining us now, attorney Effley Bailey, co-author of Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, it's an honor to have you with us here, sir.
Thank you.
You know, when we talk about the art of the cross-examination, it's always pumped up in movies. It's always pumped up in TV. How realistic is the popular media perception of what really happens in the courtroom?
There have been several movies where it was really well done. Most of them are trash. I mean, they simply break every rule in the book to get dramatic effect. But there are some movies like To Kill a Mockingbird and Anatomy of a Murder where it was done pretty much according to the book. And it's a trick to keep cross-examination interesting because if you're doing it properly, there are spots where it's going to be very dull.
Mr. Bailey, why does everybody want to be a lawyer?
Well, I haven't figured that out because it's not the finest life in the world. It presents a lot of difficulties and cutthroat competition and playing close to the edge of the cliff. I did not recommend any of my sons be lawyers, and if I had to do it over again, I have grave doubts that I would seek that end of the road. However, I must point out that when I wanted to be a lawyer back in the 50s, it was a whole different and, to my mind, much more pleasant ballgame.
Well, a lot of folks may not know that you were a Marine aviator, and once a Marine, always a Marine. Did that help you in the courtroom, sir?
It did, because too many lawyers have been timid at times when they needed to strike boldly forth. And Marines tend to be afraid of very little, if anything. And so if there were an opportunity that took a little bit of chutzpah, I would likely march into the fray. And often I would get my head clobbered, but more often I would wind up with some kind of score. And, you know, you can't tell what's under a rock unless you lift it.
Excellence in Cross-Examination, Effley Bailey with Kevin Miller here at 580 KIDO. Can we learn anything from the art of cross-examination and how to deal with people at work or, you know, how to settle disagreements in our own life?
The book was intended to reach a very wide audience, not just lawyers, but witnesses, particularly expert witnesses, people that are thinking of getting into litigation. It will show them the uncertainty of the outcome and also the scarcity of really good trial lawyers out there and some checklists by which to make sure you get one because they're hard to get. On the other hand, if you do have a very good, well-prepared trial lawyer, it immeasurably increases your chances of winning the case. So it's worth doing. That's what the book is all about. It really is a pathway to excellence in cross-examination. Just reading it is not going to make you a good cross-examiner.
What's the biggest misconception about you that you found?
Well, I think it goes with the territory, but the remark I would most often hear from new acquaintances after we'd been together for an hour or so was, kind of, gee, you're really a nice guy. I hadn't expected that. Because the picture is one of a slashing, angry, scowling cross-examiner beating the witness into a pulp as he cowers on the witness stand, and Hollywood has simply helped that image along. The fact is, we very good cross-examiners very rarely get tough with a witness unless he or she richly deserves it and asks for it.
Is that a feeling of comfort that you're trying to establish in the cross, that the witness becomes comfortable, therefore they might not be so guarded and offer something that can help your client?
Yes, that's certainly one technique. One of the phases of cross-examination, I mean, people think it's all about impeachment and attacking witnesses. It is not. One of the early phases in cross-examination is to get from the witness all of the things that he or she knows that is good, are good, about your case that the other side hasn't developed. For instance, you might want to ask a police officer in a criminal case, isn't it true that the defendant won some medals when serving in the Navy 4 years ago? And that's good stuff for a jury to hear. It's not likely the prosecutor will have brought it out, but if it's true, the police officer pretty usually will say yes.
Joining us with F. Lee Bailey, our great friend Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, and Alan always brags about you. He's met you, and he has some specific questions. Alan?
It's good to talk to you again, Lee. It's been said that people don't believe it if they see it. They see it only if they believe it. So if that's the case, how does the role of cross-examination fit into the so-called truth-seeking process of a trial?
Well, there really is a dual responsibility. One is to get at what the witness really knows and may be willing to lie about unless guided forcefully along the road. And the other is to make sure that the jury understands what the witness has said. And this sometimes requires, although I don't like the process, the old adage that teachers rely on. Tell them what you're going to say, then say it, then tell them what you said. And somewhere along the line it will stick. It all depends to a large extent on the intellect of the jury. If you've got a military jury, they've all been to college, they're pretty smart, there's no point in trying to paint a picture three times. But if you've got a rural jury with not many high school educated members on it, you have to go slow and be as graphic and explicit as you can, and often be repetitive.
How does one find a good lawyer, sir?
That is the biggest mystery in the world. The first place you look is lawyers, because lawyers know who the good trial lawyers are. One of the tests that I always use when coming into a new community would be to say to someone who was a practitioner, not necessarily a superstar, if you were in really deep trouble, which, if any, of the local members of the bar would you hire and be comfortable with as your chief counsel? And you begin to dredge up names and reputations in that way. For me, the most direct way is to sit and talk with a lawyer. If he's a good trial lawyer, it'll be sticking out all over him, subconsciously perhaps, after 30 minutes.
Of course, that's billable hours.
Well, a lot of trial lawyers don't work for billable hours. Many of them work on a contingent fee in personal injury and wrongful death. Many of them work on a flat fee in criminal cases. If you don't get it up front, you probably never will. And, of course, those working on billable hours have a different motive than those who are not. The longer they can drag a case out, the more billable hours will be brought to the attention of the client.
What other goals do you have or objectives in mind when you cross-examine a witness, Lee? You mentioned impeachment as one of them. What other goals and objectives do you have?
Well, first of all, people must understand that witnesses are trying to emulate a videotape recorder, and that's a tall order. They can't see everything at once, and they can't remember it. So that you've got to explore the process with this witness as to this event, as to how the memory was created. And that begins with perception. What did you hear? That's usually the first introduction to an event, because hearing works over 360 degrees horizontally and vertically. Then what did you see? And by that you really mean, what did you perceive? You can see 180 degrees from your 90 on either side of your nose. You can only perceive in an arc of 5 to 10 degrees, and people can be talked into thinking they saw things they didn't. Then the question is, why did you remember this? If it was your mother's funeral, of course you would. If it's what you had for breakfast a year ago, that's suspicious, unless it's tied to another event. Then how well have you remembered? Every prosecutor in the case, or every plaintiff's lawyer, and every lawyer for every side, and a horde of investigators have all been trying to get you to remember a story favorable to them. How have you been able to resist that? And the last thing that they have to do is to articulate with accuracy the picture in their mind that they carried forward perhaps for several years from the date of the incident that's being litigated. That's phase one. How did you get to be this witness? Then one likes to go into the nice things that one can develop about one's own client, and then, if necessary and not otherwise, the role of impeachment, discrediting the witness, making his story or her story less believable than you think your witnesses will be, because that's how cases are won. They're not won by witnesses breaking down on the witness stand and saying, oh, I lied, woe is me. That's Hollywood stuff.
F. Lee Bailey with us, Kevin Miller, Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law, 580-KIDO. Now, I love this title, How to Protect Yourself Against Cops in California and Other Strange Places. How do you protect yourself from the cops?
Well, I wrote the book about that. It was for travelers going to other cities and explaining a little bit how the cops operate on OUI. Or if they get mad at you, as this one did at me, they'll dream up an OUI. But there was a lot that was known about driving under the influence, driving while impaired. Various states call it various things and still have different blood alcohol limits that are accepted by their statutes. And so I thought a book might be helpful to explain to people what to do and what not to do if you are going to drive after you've been drinking, hopefully a moderate amount, or if you're going to be accused of drinking even though you haven't been.
More coming up with F. Lee Bailey, Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580-KIDR, great friend. Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law with us. Excellence in Cross-Examination is Mr. Bailey's new book. We'll talk more about that, and we'll get into some of his more colorful adventures next.
The D&B Garden Show with Debbie Cook, Saturday mornings at 10 on 580-KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to 580-KIDO, home of Kevin Miller in the Morning. Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law with us. Why? Because we have a very special guest with us, Attorney F. Lee Bailey, author of the new book, Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, we've got to ask you, and I'm sure you talk about this in the book, O.J. Simpson's victory, and when everybody had the goods on him, he was innocent. How did that happen?
Well, I don't talk in that about the book because I've written a very extensive chapter in that. It's at my website, Bailey and Elliott. People that are really interested in what did happen in the Simpson case, and more importantly, what did not, can read it. It's a very reliable, factual account. And I think the most interesting segment, it describes all the evidence we couldn't put in because we were losing our jury to illnesses. And had we lost the jury, there would have been a mistrial. The prosecution, as a good indicator, they knew they had a crummy case, refused to go along with less than 12 jurors. And had they agreed to go along, we could have gotten down to 6 and still finished the trial. But there are a number of cases, some mine, some done by other lawyers, where the cross-examination is detailed. And by that, I mean hic verba, which is Latin for word for word. And then I make comments in the form of footnotes on what I believe the lawyer was doing. In my case, I know what I was doing, and whether it worked or not. And this is one of the best ways for young lawyers who can't always arrange to get to sit in what we call the second chair in a good trial and learn from a senior colleague. This is the second best way of learning. Study actual cross-examinations. I think there are seven in this book, and we'll add another one every year.
But what about the cross-examination of Furman? Was everything on the line then?
Well, it was. I only had one objective where Furman was concerned. I had a mole in the prosecution who told me they were taking him in the grand jury room at night and trying to train him to say yes when I asked him if he ever used the N-word. And so my job was to get him so worked up that despite this training, he could not say yes, he would lie about it, because I knew, and this is before the tapes were discovered, I knew I had plenty of evidence that he used that word viciously and frequently. And so the objective was get Furman to deny that he ever, within 10 years, used the N-word. We couldn't go more than 10 years because 11 years back, he'd signed an affidavit saying how much he hated the N-people and that he needed to be retired on a pension because he was burned out. Judge Ito found that to be too stale, conveniently, and so said you're limited to 10 years, and that's why my questions were directed at the last 10 years. And sure enough, Furman took the bait, said no, he was a cook goose from that point forward.
What was that like working with the Dream Team and the late Johnny Cochran?
Working with Johnny Cochran was great. There was no Dream Team, not by a long shot. There were some good lawyers there. There were some who weren't particularly good. There were too many of them by far. The trial dragged on for 9 months. It was not worth three in most jurisdictions. And I would say that the entire experience, which had its moments, like the acquittal, was generally unpleasant.
Alan L. Morton, you have a question for Mr. Bailey?
How do you prepare for cross-examine, Lee? We consider you in our trade as a virtuoso attorney. We'd like to hear from you as to what you do to prepare.
And certainly they're applicable to people that aren't lawyers as
Absolutely, because when you're talking about the business environment, preparing for a conference, maybe even an adversary.
Or a presentation, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, the answer is you do everything under the sun. There is an extensive chapter in the book on preparation because, as Melvin Belli, a famed tort lawyer out in California, once said, if your investigator is good enough, most any lawyer will do. And while that, like a lot of what Mel said, and he was a good friend of mine, was an exaggeration, there is a lot of truth in it, because if you've got the facts on your side, you don't have to be handsome or swashbuckling or look like a movie star. You're going to win the case most of the time. So you dig, you look under rocks, you interview everyone you possibly could, sometimes more than once, and try to get the facts down on the one hand that favor your case, and try to get enough facts, not on paper, but in your memory, to take apart any witness who could do you substantial damage.
And, of course, if not, just Google a lot and do your own research. So, in other words, be prepared.
Be prepared, and that means it was best put by my mentor when I was young. He was the cock of the walk in criminal law. His name was Edward Bennett Williams. I had lunch with him the day after I took the bar and months before I was admitted, but I'd tried to quit him a few cases in the military, even though I hadn't been to law school. And I said, Mr. Williams, sometimes you seem to pull a rabbit out of a hat. How do you do that? He said, you come prepared with 50 rabbits and 50 hats, and you get very lucky.
Mr. Bailey, a final thought. We started this interview at 580 KIDO when you said that if you had to do it all over again, you wouldn't have been a lawyer. You would have thought about it more than that. But, I mean, you've been successful. You're famous. You've been a part of American history, not only legal history, but American history. Why the regret?
Well, the regrets are several. First of all, I think I was not treated very well by the bar, but I will survive that. And at the end of the day, I'll write about it. And hopefully that's where history will notch the events. But quite a bit beyond that, the practice of law has changed drastically. The public defender was thought to be a great addition to the legal system. It hasn't worked out that way. Public defenders are people that often can't get better jobs elsewhere. They're totally overloaded. They're not well experienced. They don't get the help in the form of investigators and experts and scientific evidence that they need. And I think the telling symbol of that is of the 13 people found to be innocent but sitting on death row in Illinois, all had been represented by a public defender. Almost all were minorities. Their trials had been skimpy, and they were saved from execution only by DNA. So I think a system that's been watered down that bad is not to be admired or chased. If we would go to the British system, where you prosecute one day, defend the next, and trial lawyers are specially certified and recognized, I think we could cure a lot of that. Here in Maine, for instance, there is no public defender system. The judge appoints a lawyer, and usually a competent one, who doesn't get the best of all worlds, but gets more help than public defenders, say, for instance, in New York City.
Boy, that's incredible when you you think about it. The best legal system money can buy, and you take a look at some big major cases. You look at the Duke LaCrosse case. If those guys didn't have competent trial, competent counsel, what would have happened to them?
That's right, and it's a shame because I think capital cases should have their own bar, lawyers that are authorized to try capital cases, simply because mistakes by lawyers are fatal to the client. When they're discovered years later, as often happens through DNA or some other revelation, it's kind of tough to go to the graveside and tell the client, oh boy, we have a new trial order. If only you could attend. So that's a miserable part of the system. I think capital lawyers should be specially chosen from the very top ranks, well paid for what they do, because it would save money in the end and make damn sure that we don't execute innocent people.
Excellence in cross-examination. Mr. Bailey, thank you, sir.
All right. Nice talking with you.
All right. We appreciate that. Before we go, Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, this is one of your heroes. What are your thoughts?
Well, when I was a young man, I read Mr. Lee's book, The Defense Never Rests. It was one of the precipitating factors in the decision I made that I set a goal to go to law school. And so
he said he wouldn't do it again. What about you?
Well, the practice of law has truly changed.
Yes or no?
I have raised 5 children, and each of them have followed their mothers.
Is this the courtroom or is this the courtroom of public opinion? Yes or no? Mr. Bailey didn't have a problem saying he wouldn't do it again.
I have mixed emotions. I haven't made up my mind, but I will say this, that my children have seen the sacrifices that I've had to make along the way to bring justice on behalf of clients. And it's not, if you think this is a 5-day 9-to-5 job, you're sadly mistaken.
All right. Some words of inspiration from Alan L. Morton, attorney at law. We appreciate that, sir.
You're very welcome.
All right. You're listening to Kevin Miller, 580KIDO.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays at noon. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the morning, 580KIDO. Joining us now, Dan Stein from FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
we're okay in Idaho, but what about America when we're talking about the president just kind of making it up as he goes? What does that mean for all of us?
Well, it means an awful lot because in the end, we're not a nation that's tied together by ethnicity or religion or language or any of those things anymore. We're really tied together by a national commitment to an idea and a frame of government that we call Republican democracy. We have a system of checks and balances because we have a tripartite government, and that means that under our Constitution, Congress makes the immigration laws. It's considered a plenary power of Congress, which means it really goes to sovereignty and who we are as a country. And historically, the Supreme Court has given enormous deference to Congress and how it identifies not only who gets to come, but also the procedural process that's established in terms of whether, you know, what kind of a deportation hearing an alien gets and the various criteria for removing aliens. Well, this president is, as we well know, very ideological. He's a bit extreme, to put it mildly. He has a very strong constituent base within his party and people who are operatives within his administration and allied with them. They simply oppose all immigration controls, and they want to stop all deportations. They've been putting pressure on him, and they've been working with people like Chuck Schumer and others in the Senate. And as usual, there's a few Republicans that go along with it, and they put together this Gang of Eight bill in the Senate that was never really drafted to pass the House, and John Boehner made it clear it was never going to be brought up. But now Barack Obama has done something historically unprecedented. He has stolen from the American people the right to decide who may come. He is giving away residency in the United States and American jobs for political favors and graft to try to get votes from a particular constituency. And this is an outrageous corruption of the democratic process. And frankly, from a personal standpoint, I mean, at least here at FAIR, what Bill Clinton did, lie on an affidavit about, sexual relations with some woman, seems a lot less significant than, what Obama has done. This is just the beginning. I mean, he's been doing things for 6 years to destroy America's immigration control apparatus. He says 5 million today, but you can be sure. Remember what Bill Clinton did the last day in office? He pardoned all these criminals. Wait till we get to see the next 6 million or so.
Dan, let's take a look at just some of the factors that you talked about, the lost art of assimilation. And we talk about that America has been a nation of immigrants, but that doesn't mean that everybody should camp out and come to America. There have always been laws and standards, and there's been moratoriums in the past on immigration.
Well, we've had sustained periods of much lower immigration, certainly most of the 20th century. That was a period where we saw the resurgence of a stable American middle class, particularly after the Second World War. We saw advancement in the civil rights movement, and certainly in terms of income inequality, we saw that narrow in the 50s and 60s as unions became quite strong in this country, and mass production was the envy of the world. We had enormous value added to manufacturers. The so-called civil rights movement decided in 1965 to begin this tidal wave of unprecedented immigration. And we've had 40 years of the highest levels we've ever had in our history. Not surprisingly, the American middle class is disappearing. at the same time, we're outsourcing all these good jobs over the last 30 years. We've been insourcing, millions and millions of lower and less skilled workers and some higher skilled workers. Family is the guiding determinant of whether you get a visa, not what you know. And because of chain migration, the numbers continue to the potential is for them to grow exponentially. There's no reason why we should have so much immigration, particularly when you have a national health care system and a large social safety net, which is attracting people with less skills and education. What we have is a bona fide crisis here, and this is what the media, they don't want to talk about. The media continues to act like this is just business as usual, like, oh, you know how the, they always say, well, some other president did it too. No other president did anything like this. And what's more importantly is Obama, in making us pay for education, for health care, for housing, for, school lunches and remedial language training and subsidizing college tuition, everything else for people here illegally, is also failing to articulate any practical limit to this new power he claims that he has of bringing in or rewarding millions of people who are here illegally.
And the issue that a lot of us have is, what about Congress, Dan?
Well, see, here's the problem. Congress realizes, Obama made a mistake at one level. what he did was to say to Congress, well, I really don't care what you say. And naturally, politicians and folks like the great Chuck Grassley and others, they realize that this is a massive insult to Congress. Politicians are more than happy to stand behind a president ceremonially in a lousy bill and try to claim victory, even if it's a lousy product, because politicians never want to look like they're losing. You know that, right? But what the president has done has made Congress look like they're irrelevant. And that's the cardinal sin in this business. And that's why they're so outraged. But in the end, if the president says, I'm not going to enforce the law, if Congress passes a bill that says we're going to repeal this executive order and you have to deport people you find, it doesn't matter whether they're criminals or, you know, whatever, they're here illegally, they need to go into deportation proceedings, he's going to veto the bill. So now he's saying, I'm a law unto myself. Congress can't make me. Now they can defund, and we've been working with members on that issue of trying to defund the DHS program to administer what will be an impossible program of hundreds of thousands of visa applications every month. There's no way they have the resources to check the background, security background, verify ID or anything. So it's going to be rubber stamp out the wazoo. If Congress defunded that, the argument is that USCIS under DHS, that they couldn't actually process the applications. And then there's naturally the I word. And while the Republican Party doesn't want to talk about impeachment, certainly not the leadership at this point, it is a question. What does the president have to do in this area to qualify for impeachment? Because in the end, immigration control is about national sovereignty and security. Border control is an extension of both foreign affairs and national defense. And in the end, if the president is failing to carry out, say, repelling a hostile invasion. I mean, if you've got 20, you know, if you have a hostile foreign army of, you know, 50,000 troops occupying Florida, and the president says, you know, I think they basically got a good case, you know, we stole it from them. Well, is that an impeachable offense? Or is it an impeachable offense if the president won't carry out these core and essential functions of ensuring our borders are controlled and people don't just crash our borders? So in the end, somebody's going to have to say to the president, you know, one of those big red lines, right? You know, you can't cross. If you start just bringing in people who have no right to be here because you just happen to like them and you reward millions and millions of people and make us taxpayers pay for it, this rends the entire sort of constitutional scheme, and they're going to have to draw a line.
Dan Stein joining us, Kevin Miller in the Morning from FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform. How much flack do you all take for your efforts to save America, hashtag defund amnesty?
How much flack? Well, I mean, we have this polarized world right now where, you know, we have an administration that's aligned with these very extremist organizations that like to demonize, because that's a lot easier than winning arguments on the merits. Arguments, you know, Americans don't have those kind of discussions anymore. We just name call, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you get kind of used to this, but, you know, the more effective you are, the more flack you're going to take. So we take a lot of flack.
Indeed. Let's continue on when we're talking about the jobs that are lost to the illegals. You go back to in the South, carpenters, contractors, brick masons used to be the backbone of American trades. Now, not so much.
Yeah. Well, we lost a lot of our manufacturing, of course, and that was a big part of our national culture. I mean, manufacturing was the center of our national culture, along with farming. And certainly a lot of construction trades have been, all you have to do is look at what's happened to the American labor force. Labor force participation is as low as we haven't seen in 50 years, 45 years. Americans have dropped out of the labor force. They're not going to go out there and try to compete with these illegal workers in drywall and areas of construction. A lot of the trades have been taken over in that regard, because the way immigration works is that it undercuts the labor market because particularly illegal immigrants, but even legal at some level, manages to lower wages in any given sector. Americans have rightly better expectations for what these kind of jobs are going to pay. Employers then want to pay less. They prefer the immigrant workers and the illegal workers, and pretty soon they dominate in that labor market, so that it's kind of like Americans are getting squeezed. We're outsourcing all these manufacturing jobs, and now we're insourcing all this labor. And in the end, it's becoming clear there's really no obvious economic model for where most Americans will fit in the future American economy.
Well, and then we subsidize them, Dan, as you've pointed out here at 580KIDO with Kevin Miller in the morning, because we take care of their medical, the taxpayers, we take care of their kids' education, we take care of all these things that offer a subsidy to these folks that come here illegally.
Yeah, they get to stay and we get to pay. Earned income tax credit, Obamacare, Social Security after they've earned some credits, Medicaid. I mean, what is the point in a society like ours, a post-industrial information society? Why are we bringing in people who are illiterate in any language with a fifth-grade education? If we're going to be bringing in immigrants, first of all, it ought to be legal. The numbers should be much lower, and they ought to be people who can expand our productive potential in very high value-added, you know, research and things that will expand the productive potential of the American economy. But this idea that somehow every single job sector in this country is now a job that they say Americans aren't good enough to do, and it doesn't matter whether it's harvesting cantaloupe out in the fields or picking strawberries or working on microprocessors or computer programming or running Google. It just goes on and on. And we, as a nation, we've kind of lost confidence in our ability to self-determination, the can-do spirit, the fierce independence that we used to have. And the American elites, who are this emerging class of people who run companies like Google and Apple and stuff, I mean, they're so far removed from the experience of the average American anymore that we really have, there's just a complete disconnect. These elites are moving toward this globalized labor market, and they see the nation state as kind of an historic, a historic oddity. Because they're moving on. They're not worried about they're taking their money and moving it out of the country, trying to avoid U.S. taxes. So,
Dan, please stand by. More coming up next at 580KIDO with Kevin.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.